No, la mela bigata, amiga. Esta okay, here we go. So you have learned about synchronous languages from Stavros. So today is about a sort of a general framework when you can embed all the model computation that you've seen so far. So the modern engineering, if you like, has changed dramatically in the sense that we have to deal with heterogeneous system, meaning that we have got various parts that get connected together, and these parts are growing by leaps and bounds. So there is also a great desire to start merging mechanical components with electronic components and try to analyze them together and to co-design them. So when you start thinking about merging mechanical and electronics, all of a sudden you find yourself dealing with partial differential equation, ordinary differential equation, logic. And the point is that if you want to analyze it, you have to be able to to do something with the interface of these objects, right? And so the need of finding a common framework where you can put all of this together is very much felt. So all the directions in research in the area of embedded systems point to that, right? So in fact, the field of what is called cyber-physical systems is about that, right? So they are called cyber-physical because cyber is supposed to be the digital part and physical is supposed to be the physical part, in fact. I hate the name. I can't stand it. I think it's a horrible name. But what can we do? That's the way they call it, so we got to go with it. So, the key question that we have to ask ourselves is that what does it mean to put two different models together? I mean, what is the meaning of that sentence? Now, putting them together means that they exchange information and that the guy who's receiving information from the other understands what this guy is telling him. But again, if we, I always use the example of human languages because there is a lot to be said about that analogy because we are talking about communication, about semantics. But if, for example, all of a sudden I start speaking in Italian, I guess my friend here, Alberto, is the only one who's going to understand a damn thing, right? And so assume that I can't speak English and then there is no communication, so I can tell all wonderful lectures that you... So what is that? It means that there is no way for you to understand the sentences I'm saying, so there is no way of understanding what I mean, right? So there is no common ground where we can put these things. But we have people from Denmark, and we have people from Italy, and we have people from Japan, and we have people from all over the world, and we can interact. And where is that today, now? Because I speak in English, sort of, and you understand English, sort of, right? And so that is where we need. And so, and that is what we have done. I'm trying to think about what is happening, right? So we learn language when we were born, and so we map our mental frame onto a mathematical framework, which is language, right? So we have a way of expressing what we think, right? Now, you were born in Denmark, you learn a different way, but it's the same mental principles, more or less. Granted that Italians may or may not be more stupid than Danish, but assume that we are equally intelligent, then the brain works more or less the same, right? And so the origin is the same, except that it gets mapped into two different implementations, right? Now, when we put them together, we have to recover what is common, which is our mental process, and then map it yet into another place, which is English, right? And so what happens is that we have brain, Italian, Danish, English, right? So that's what happens, right? So in English, we kind of mean the same thing as we meant in Danish or in Italian. By the way, since the languages have all slightly different form and so on, it's very difficult sometimes to render a particular thought which is expressed in a particular language in another language. So that's the reason why you have translators that are better than others, because you have to change completely the sentence to give the same idea, right? So the same thing, because when you put a finite state machine together with a data flow, it is something that is better expressed here and something is better expressed there. So how can we translate that? Aha! We have to find some common origin from these things, and then we have to find a common language to exchange the information, bottom line, right? So we started thinking about this long, many years, but we couldn't find, you know, this. I always had this very clear, because in the language analogy, I think, is the right one, and so it's easy to understand and to explain, but to find then a mathematical framework where you kind of do the same thing as I just told you is not that easy. So it took like 5-6 years until we found something. This is one something, and then there will be next class we are going to do the next something. And in this work that Professor Lee and I have done, we kind of went to the minimum common denominator of stuff, right? So we went to the maximum granularity of what things are meant to do. Now, the other framework that I'm going to talk about later on, which is something that Roberto Passanoni did as his thesis, took us 10 years to do it, but that is a completely different view, which is mimicking almost exactly what I told you in terms of the language. Almost the same. Except that finally we found the mathematical constant to be able to express that. So, first thing was this thing. And interestingly enough, this paper is, what is this? Interestingly enough, this is a paper that got so many citations. We are about 500 citations, and it's not that old. It was published in 1998. So it's a reason why, I mean, if you think carefully, is that once you have some framework like this, then you can use it to prove results, and that is the maximum usage of this thing. So people have found it useful to use this framework to prove theorems about, you know, model of computation that they derive, about designs that they did, and things like that. So that's the reason why it got cited so much. Okay, so let's see how we go about it. Well, now, since we both love very much art, so get ready. We are going to start with some art here. So the point is that, as I told you, there is this process of abstraction and refinement that always takes place in design, right? So you always abstract something or you refine something. So when you do design, you refine. When you analyze design, most of the time you abstract. So again, if you look at what it means, is that you go away or withdraw from physical properties of the implementation, try to capture the common glue, and you get closer to the problem domain. Design capture, if you use high level of abstraction, you avoid over specification. So for example, take again a finite state machine, and I'm using this example because you must have done quite a lot of finite state machines by now. You know about incompletely specified finite state machines, for example, which means that under some combination of inputs, I don't care what my machine does, because these inputs may not be meaningful at all. Suppose, for example, that I have three actions that I want to take, so three inputs that I want to look at, and then we know that if we are going to go to implementation, we need to encode these guys, and encoding needs bits. And so in order to the minimum length encoding is going to be 2 bits, but with 2 bits you have 4 combinations, right, and not only 3. So there is one combination of inputs that doesn't make sense because it's not corresponding to any symbol that makes sense, right? So why do we have to specify that, right? We don't, right? It's free, right? And so it's incompletely specified. Now, if we go down and we look at the implementation of the finite state machine, when we put gates in it, when we put logic, then what happens is that all the transitions are specified. because we have signals come in and then gate chuck latch chuck, so everything is fully instantiated. Okay, so but it's over specified. Why? Because there is encoded in there some decision that we took arbitrarily when we had to specify the combination of bits that did not correspond to any meaningful thing, right? And so if you do at the abstract level, so you use the symbols instead of encoding, you avoid over-specification. If you put the bits in there, you over-specify, right? So abstraction is a way of avoiding over-specifying when you get to design. So this Pete Mondrian, this is an abstract painter that you can easily say. But the same guy, long ago, was used to paint these guys, right? And so this was a tree, it's pretty close to a tree, and then this even closer, so yes, another tree. So what happened is that in all this painting, there is a tree, except that the first one, I challenge anyone to see that was a tree, right? That was the abstraction of a tree. Now, there is another interesting thing about this notion of abstraction, why people have looked at this concept for so many years. But if you look at the most wonderful piece of philosophy that you can find is, in terms of elegance or art or whatever you want, is Plato, right? Platonic, as we say in Italian, Plato. So what did Plato say? Well, Plato said that, how come we can recognize that the tree is a tree, right? We have never seen a particular tree. We look at it, say that is a tree. So if you go, I never saw a baobab, but I'm sure that if I go in Africa and I see this huge tree, I say, this is a tree. And so how come we can apply this notion of a tree to all these instances? It's because we have an abstraction, right, of the tree. We have one idea about trees, and then we see if the trees that we see are refinements of that idea. Okay? And so even at the time of the ancient Greeks, this notion of one archetype, we call it archetype, was corresponding to a series of instances, was clear to people. Okay, but didn't have, of course, a mathematical concept there. So one of the most important things to deal with and to abstract or to refine or to play with is time. In all the action of engineering, at some point we have to deal with time. Okay, why is that? Because the physical world is embedded in time. Now, then, sooner rather than later, we take a specification and we will go towards a world where time is present. Now, the question then is, physical time, is it useful, is bad, is screwing us up, is an opportunity, is a cost, and what does it mean to abstract time away? What do we use time for when we design? So, well, if you start thinking about, you know, I want to solve the vending machine control problem, right, there is no time that we need. It's just a logical operation. I put in the coins and the Coke comes out, right? Is there any timing involved? There is sequencing, and that's fine, like a data flow sequencing. So if you don't put the money first, the Coke doesn't come out. Would be nice otherwise. But, you know, let's leave it alone. That is, so there is a causality, no? So money in, Coke out. But that's it, right? So that is a notion, if you like. When we think about time, time tells us how events occur. So this comes before that, right? We have this notion of time that helps us to put things in a row, in some sense, right? They order things, right? And no matter what happens in the physical world, we can always say something has happened before something else, right? So that is called also global time or physical time, and global time and physical time is a globally ordered system. So set. So that if you take any element of a set, you can always say if it is larger or smaller than some other elements of a set, can also be equal. Okay. So the one thing that time does is putting things in a line. Now, when something comes after something else, can you say that there is, that must be? Sometimes yes, sometimes no, right? Sometimes things are ordered in time, but they are not causally related, okay? So in fact, in the old time, the priests and the like, I mean, in the time of the prehistoric time, people tended to associate this comes first, this comes after, it's cause and effect, right? So this thing comes first, and then this thing happens, then it means that they are causally related. So, for example, if you wear a blue skirt, then you go well at an exam, then you think, oh, every time I wear a blue skirt, it's going to be nice, because I'm going to pass the exam. How many of you do this? I used to do it. So, you know, no. And so, that is a wrong causality, right? So we say, well, there was a sequencing, right, that was not causality related, but I put a consequence in it, and I put an arc that is not there, right? And that's what happens also in design, right? When we look at what we see, we can infer that this must be after and doesn't have to be. So it's over specification, right? Or misinterpretation, like in the case of this, I hope, because otherwise I'm in trouble. Because actually, in my case, that's not a good idea. I use a white skirt. Okay, so that's the secret to get good grades at exams. Okay, so now, that's continuous time, that we said everything is ordered. Then we had another example where, for example, money in, coke out, and this is it. This is called a partially ordered discrete event set, which means that we capture only causality there. Now, we have seen all kinds of different models of computation. We look at discrete time, discrete event. Remember that that was one of the simplest models of computation. We look at that. We took one slide to talk about it, not much to talk about. Then we look at synchronous reactive models, last class. We look at concurrent finite state machines. We look at data flow array. We look at patterning. So each one of them has a particular notion of time. I don't know why it goes into. Is the battery on? Yeah. So anyway, so for sure there is a relationship between all these notion of times, and in particular, we can say that continuous time is a refinement of all of these things, right? So if we specify, for example, a global order over here, and then we place it in precise correspondence with the order set, then we can interpret this diagram as in continuous time, okay? So certainly there is a relationship between this and of abstraction and refinement. But certainly there may be situation in which this is not necessarily a refinement of that. This is always a refinement of everything, but not necessarily this or that. Right? They can be quote unquote in parallel, right? And that's when the difficulty arises, right? You got two guys that mean really different things, so you can exchange information. But if you map everything there, then you can indeed do that. But notice that if you do this kind of operation, then there is some degree of arbitrariness. For example, these three objects are not related, right? So if I refine this description into that, then E, F, and G will be related. And then, oh my God, all of a sudden we can compare this guy and this guy, but we don't compare this guy, but really something that has more information. I inserted more information in it. Okay, so this is the nice aspect of heterogeneous system from a theoretical point of view. Now, among this, which in your opinion is a less constrained view of time? Least constrained view of time? The thing that leaves you more free to refinement. Well, pretty obvious, isn't it? One, two, three. No, it's actually partially ordered discrete. Because this one, the only thing that it expresses is causality, right? And nothing else, nothing more. And here, the discrete multi-rate, you see that you have these events which are aligned, so there is a constraint that you don't have here, right? So partially ordered discrete events is actually the least constrained notion of time. Now this one we get into the philosophical, in the sense that in my opinion, there is, when we start thinking about a particular design, we always have in mind that thing, partial order, because it's causality, right? This must follow that. Now, we'll see why that is important, right? So, I've not been able to convince yet everybody, but one of these things. So, and so we don't have, for example, an explanation for how things flow from here, maybe to here or to there, and then down to there. But, I just now decided that I'm going to show you, before doing the more general embedding of different models of computation, I'm going to show you how I can start with a synchronous reactive model, but then go into an asynchronous model and maintain the same properties, okay, which is quite important, because then I can guarantee that certain behaviors from my system are not going to happen, and so all the analysis that I've done at the synchronous level is going to be true also at the last implementation level. Sorry. Okay. So we discussed totally ordered discrete event models. So the example of a sort of problems that arise from a computerized model of physical time is when you have things that happen at the same time, quote unquote, right? Why is that? Because when you embed in continuous time, having two things that occur exactly at the same instant is very rare, right? In general, there is you really have to be terribly unlucky or terribly lucky to have two things overlap exactly. So there is always kind of this ordering that is taking place. But if you discretize things, even if events that are ordered this way or that way, then they are mapped onto the same time, so that you can have some logical inconsistency, if you like. So, assume that you have a situation like this, where you have these two inputs, the green line that goes to P1 and P2, and then assume that P1 can produce the output at the very same time that it receives the input. So no time delay whatsoever. Now, what is the correct sequence of outputs of P2? Because you could have, you could react to this, and then to this, and then you change this and you see what happens, or you can do this first, then this, and you have a different solutions, or you can have them at the same time. So there is an arbitrariness that is taking place here, just because P1 is reacting in zero time to its input. Now, also, what does this mean? What is the meaning of having an output the same thing of the input, right? Because now, if F has no delay, it is very badly defined, unless we do something, right? And so, when we say that there is a block that does merge, and you have two signals, S1 and S2, and we say that then S3 is the union of these two signals, what happens if there are events that occur at exactly the same time between S1 and S2? We say the same, the sum of the two, what, right? So these are kind of interesting things that we have to look at in looking at these various models of time. So what is the tag signal model? The tag signal model is a mathematical framework within which the essential properties of model computation can be understood and compared. So that was the origin of our goals. So it's a denotational framework. So you can talk about things, but you don't use it to do designs or things of that sort. So it's a help in understanding, if you like. Now, why we call it tag signal model? So if you have a signal, in general, you have this notion of what it is. It's a signal is a set of events, an event is a pair of value time. It's the value that the signal takes, and time is the time in which this value is true. So in the notion of signals in general, this time is always there. Now, but that time can have very many different interpretations. So it can be a time which is continuous time, so it's globally ordered. It can be a synchronous time, quote unquote, so it's logical time, it's not a real time. It just simply says when things occur, but not when. I mean, what occurs together, but doesn't tell you how much time it goes between one set of events and another set of events. It just simply says that certain things occur, then there is another operation and something else occurs. So, we see that there is a logical notion of time, there is a global ordering notion of time, we also saw the partial ordering, right? So, well, is then a way of not over-interpreting time, right? Of saying, of getting away from this notion that everything, that signals are associated with time. And so we generalize the idea of events by using tests. Okay, so instead, think about event as a pair, value, fine. But instead of having time as the second object of the pair, think about a tag, right? A tag means it could take value in red, blue, and green, right? And so you can have 5 green, 6 red, and 10 whatever, right? Blue, right? So there is an association between two fields. One is the value, and the other one is the tag. So it's formed by these two pairs. But the other element in the pair is not necessarily time, something else. Now, why is this useful? Because you can do then, you can implement easily this notion of partial order, right? Because you don't have to put it in correspondence with the natural numbers, which are globally ordered, or continuous, or the real, so continuous time and so on. So we say, let's use tags, actually. Abstraction of time, so give us tools to deal with the questions that we posed before, with the problems of those systems where we had problems when we had zero time, so which means that everything happened simultaneously. So what is then the definition that will bring us to the tag signal model? So we have a set of values V, set of tags T, and then an event is a pair tags and values. A signal is a set of events, as we always said. Now, a functional signal is actually an interesting notion. It is a partial function from the set of tags to the set of values. So think about the standard signals in time. It's like saying at time 5, there is value 3. So we have a function that says that maps time into values, right? And in fact, we do use to say S of T, right? Signal function of time, right? So a functional signal then is something that has that relationship between text and value. So it means that the value is in correspondence with a particular text. So the set of all signal is, of course, the power set of T cross V. And n tuples of signals are indicated with bold as an element in S to the power n, which means that we have set of signals is S1, S2, S3, S4, and each one of these S is a signal. So it's defining the power set T cross V. Now, possible interpretation of text is universal time, is discrete time, is precedences, and this is actually the reason why we introduced the text. And actually, this came to... I was the one who insisted in having text instead of time. And the reason why, because I wanted to make absolutely sure that there is no confusion about time. Even in synchronous models, we tend to confuse time. You know, logical time is different from time. It's very different from time. Because it's non-metric, right? So we don't know what is the distance between two clocks, call it, right? Two lineups of elements. So if you get away from time and you call it tag, all this confusion should go away. And so one particular tag is time, as we know it, but all the rest are simply expressing relationships between events. Okay? So, all right. So again, specifying system, you avoid over-specification. Modeling system recognizes inherently the difficulty of maintaining global consistent notion of time, which is a classical problem when you have, for example, a large ship and you want to use synchronous design style is to deliver the clock signal to the entire ship. And we know delays, so the signal gets first to him, then to him, so the clock for him is different from him, but logically they should be the same. So it's a difficulty that comes in. And so we have, by using tags, we have one more degree of freedom to try to resolve these issues than we had before. Now then, as since we are going to manipulate these things, then we need an algebra. If we need an algebra, we need the null element. So we are going to talk about the empty signal, lambda. Then we are going to talk to the tuple of empty signals, capital lambda. And of course, lambda belongs to the set of signals, and capital lambda belongs to the set of signals. Now, since we said before this is a null element, if you have the operation of union, if you take a signal and you make the union with the empty signal, you give S. And for any tuple S, if you make the union with the corresponding tuple of empty signals, then you get S, which is also called the pointwise union. Okay, so that's pretty simple. So we have the null element of the algebra. Now, notice that in some models of computation, and we've seen one, the synchronous reactive model that Stavros has presented you on Tuesday, the set V of values include a special value, which is called the bottom, which indicates the absence of a signal. So, remember that in the synchronous reactive model, what happened is that when something changes at the input of the system, then the system wakes up and reacts to that. But when it reacts to that change, it has to interrogate for all the components of the system itself if there is a presence of an input or not. And so in order to make the to make things work, then we have to encode the fact that in that input there is nothing, right? The empty signal. The empty value. There is no value, but there is a tag there, and I have to look at it, right? So the tag is there, it's different from zero, but the value is not there, right? And so it's not zero, it's not there, right? And so we need to use this symbol, which is called the bottom. And in synchronous reactive language, this is always present. I mean, it's a key part of the model. Now, we have the basic object. So we have the events, which are the basic objects out of which you actually we have the values and the tags, and out of this you build events. Out of events you build signal. Now, out of signal, what do we build? We build processes. Okay. So what are processes? A process C is a subset of n signals, and a behavior in there is a set of signals which is in this process, in this set that is specified by the process. And we say in this particular case that S satisfies the process. So a process then is a set of possible behaviors. So suppose that we have a linear resistor, it is value 5, then I apply a current of 1 ampere and I get 5 volts out, okay? So we have a 5 ohm resistor, that's that. So, and assume that I have only 3 possible current, 1 ampere, 2 ampere, 3 ampere. Okay, so then the process corresponding to this is 1, 5, 2, 10, 3, 15. Okay, with the appropriate time, right? But these are the set of things that I get. And so this is the process, and then we can say that 1, 5 belongs to the process. So in some sense it's a denotational description of an object that has certain inputs and produces some outputs, right? So I don't give you the rules, but I give you this input and this output come together in some sense. Now, among all the processes, there is a particular set of processes that are of importance, and they are called connections. So a connection is a set of signals, but they have a very interesting point. There is at least one signal, actually two signals, there are at least two signals such that they are the same, as I said, as just. So, in fact, a connection is that, suppose that I am a process, he is a process, and then I want to establish a connection between the two of us. Then the obvious thing is that, okay, I have a wire to him so that all my outputs are his inputs, right? And so the connection will say, suppose that my outputs are S3, S4, and his inputs are S5 and S6. S3 is equal to S5, S4 is equal to S6. So it is a process, right? It gives me the relationship between the signals, and indeed, in this way, we will be able to describe any possible communication pattern among processes. So this is a connection, very simple. Then, given a tuple of P of processes, a system is a process that is obtained by the intersection of the processes. Now, in what sense? So I am a process, and I have my set of input-output behaviors, or behaviors, let's say. I have not defined yet input and output, so I have my set of behaviors. And you have your set of behaviors, and we are part of the system. Then the behavior of the system has to be correct. Has to be a behavior of mine and a behavior of his, because we are combined together. So the intersection of our behavior gives me the behavior of the combination of the two of us. That's what this means. So then there is another interesting point, which is called the projection. The projection is a particular process itself, but it gets away from one signal. So one signal goes away, and then we say that is a projection along signal Sj. And if I want to pick up, to find the set of signals that belongs to pi j, I have to look at all the signals that are in S, and then I'm going to pick the subset of signals dropping Sj out of that possible behavior. Okay, so I kind of smoothing away, I'm throwing away a particular signal, but by throwing it away and by keeping only a subset of the signals, I want to make sure that the signals that I'm considering are only the ones that are consistent with that signal that I don't see any longer. Okay? So that's the reason why I project, right? Because if I just say, well, I don't consider Sj, then that will not be a projection, will be another process whatsoever that may not be related to the signal I'm interested in. So let's look at an example. In here we have two processes, P1 and P2, and then two connections, P1 and P2, which are describing the fact that this particular signal is the same as, so S2 is the same as S7, and that S3 is the same as S6. So we got four processes. Now, the behavior of this system is given by the intersection of P1, P2, C1, and C2. Now, the projection Q prime is obtained by taking the process Q, eliminating signal 3 and eliminating the signal 2. And this will give me the set of behaviors of Q but without the need of having explicitly the signal S2 and S3. And why this is useful? Because we know that S2 and S3 are equal to S6 and S7, so I can get rid of them, right? So projection is also a way of getting rid of useless information. In this particular case, signal 2 and 3 are equal to 7 and 6, and so they carry redundant information, if you like. So I can project and obtain Q prime, and then is the behavior of the composition of this system, where S2 and S3 are not there any longer. Now, let's look at the notion of determinacy and what determinacy means. You know, in general, determinate is that the notion of determinacy is the fact that if I have a block, a component, and I give a particular set of input, then there is only one set of output. That's a determinate process. So, a non-deterministic process is that when you have an input, you may have multiple outputs, right? That's non-deterministic or non-determinate. So let's see how we can define determinacy that is connected to this notion that you have only one behavior in the life. So an input to a process is an external imposed constraint, a subset of Sn, such that I intersected with the process T is a total set of acceptable behavior, which means if I don't consider the inputs and I'm just looking at the process, then it's as if we have the entire set of signals which are free to range over whatever value they live in. Now, the input process is simply saying not all the values, not all the elements of the set of signals are valid. There's only a subset which is given by I. So the set of all possible inputs is a further characterization, of course, of the process. And so in this particular case, that I is exactly saying that. For example, take B, which is the set I, which is a subset of Sn, such that if I take the projection of the signal S1 with respect to I, I obtain S, which belongs to S. Now, this notion means that the first signal, C1, is specified externally, so it is in some sense determined by the set of inputs, and can take any value in the set of signals. Then we can say that the process is determinate if for all inputs I, which belongs to B, which is the space of the input, the intersection with I and P is equal to 1. Which means that we have only one possible behavior. So we have one set of inputs, there is only one behavior possible out of the process. Okay? So which then corresponds to our implicit notion of determinacy, which says that there is, given an input, there is only one output. Now, so far we have not really talked explicitly about input and output. We just, yes. Sure. Yes. Very good. Okay. Yes. Now, this one is, willingly not talk about it, but let me say what that means. If you have zero behaviors, means that the input is inconsistent with the system, but still determinate. It still is inconsistent, meaning that I give this input and the system say, I don't recognize this input, so it's not in my space. So I, remember, is a set of signals, and P is a set of signals which represent the process, so it means that this input is not in that set, so it's inconsistent, right? But still it's determinate. And this is used for proofs and the like. So that's the reason why I didn't tell you explicitly, but because it's kind of a nonsense, right? If I put an input that is not in the set of behaviors of the system, it's pretty well. No, it is an input because the input is formally defined as being a set of signals, so it could be anything. Simply say that there is no consistency. Now, why is that important? Suppose that, again, I'm combining objects, right? So for example, this is a process and I'm another process, and we put in cascade, right? And so I spit out outputs that are not in its input range, right? I mean, that do not belong to its process, right? And then the intersection of our behavior is empty, which means that we cannot be connected together. So there is a use in the sense that you could check this and then say this doesn't make sense. Okay. Now, this is fairly simple if you have, suppose that he has inputs that are valid, and suppose that this signal, the value is actually a pair, which is a current goes in and a power associated with it, right? And so assume that he will burn out if power is larger than a certain amount. So all the admissible behavior has a power below that, right? So I am another process, a block, that is delivering signals with a power larger than what you can take. So when you put them together, boom, right? And so you don't want that to happen. And so you may, and this is easy to check if the intersection is zero, because you just look at the power range and you see whether it's overlap or not. In other cases, it's very difficult to determine that there is inconsistency. But sometimes it's easy, right? Like in this case. Now, so far we have not even talked about outputs, right? I talk about outputs to make you understand, but so far there is no formal definition what outputs are. Now let's think about a partition of a state of signal. So what does it mean? That I have a process that contains n plus n signals, and then I take some of its signals and I put them in that set Sm, and some of the signal Sn, and I put them in another set. It is a partition because I split the set of signals exactly in two parts, so there is no duplication and I didn't forget about anything. There's a partition. Now, why is partition useful? So, in processes, you know, the notion of input and output is pretty natural to think about, right? And so, I can consider all the signals in the system, and I can define a group of these signals as being the input, and a group of these signals as being the output. Now, a process with inputs and outputs is a relation between them. So if I specify input and output, then I can say that a process is a relation between what I consider the input and the output. A relation you can always define, right? So a relation can be, you can have one element in Sn and many elements in Sn corresponding to that element, right? So that's a relation, not a function. A function, given a particular value of the input, you only have the value of the output, right? So it's a function. Now, it doesn't say that if you have three different inputs that they map all of the same output, that's perfectly fine, right? So the important thing is that you don't have this non-determinacy situation in which, given an input, I can have multiple outputs, right? Because then what the heck is my process really doing? Okay. Now, a functional process then is a single valued mapping from Sm to Sn. So it's when you have given a particular set of inputs, you get only a set of outputs, but not many. So it's a function. So a functional process is what we is our primitive notion, actually, of a component of a design, because we say given this input there is only one set of outputs and that's a functional process, right? But not necessarily. There may be a situation which is not the case. By the way, you may have systems that are functional with respect to one partition but are non-functional with respect to another partition of the input. So I give you a classical example of this is called the tunnel diode. Yeah, sure. Okay. And this voltage and this current. Now, for one value of the current, can be three different values of V, right? So it's non-functional. If I use I as an input and V as an output, right? But do the opposite. Use V as an input and I as an output. Is this process functional? Of course it is, right? So quite interesting, right? According to the partition that you choose, it can be functional or not. Now, this seems to be kind of artificial, but think about a process which you know FIV equals to zero. So this is gives you a particular relation that exists between I and V. Right? Now then, what I would like to do in order to build this input and output, I would like to try to build I equal G of V, or V equal to R of I, right? Such that if V is 1 and I that, this also put this to 0. Right? So this one is reading this particular relationship between I and V into an input-output map. Now, there are lots of devices, for example, in electronics that are known under this force and not under this force. So you have an equation of this shape. And so what happens is that when you, for example, analyze them with pi, in which, of course, you solve a big function of the I parameters, etc., equal 0, then inside this mega relation here, and we call this, so like just to make a difference from there, let's call this theta and this lambda. Okay. So these are a set of all voltages, this set of all currents, and this set of parameters. And then inside it, though, you have a particular element which is defined like this. And so when you're solving this Pi's equation, then as a subset of your problem, you have to solve this one. Right? So it's kind of a nested solution of equation. Now, to solve this thing would be much easier to go to start from this or from that. Right? And so there are some modeling efforts that will try to give you this function to plug in into this set of functions that you are trying to solve for. But the real thing to do would be to solve a nested nonlinear problem in which if you're asking at the top level to give you a value of V corresponding to a value of I, you actually have to solve this set of equations. And that is, as I said, it is that. Okay? And this gives you this idea about some processes that may not be functional because there is no unique way of doing this. And then every time you have to determine if there exists a relation of this form or of that form. Okay, and you do that by using numerical techniques. Okay, a process that is functional with respect to some partition is determinate for that particular set of that particular partition. Because again, a functional process means that there is a function that specify given S of M, the value of S of N, and so the only way in which this can be a function is that there is a unique behavior, so which means that the process is determinate. So, okay, so suppose that P1 is functional with respect to this partition, in which we identify as output S5 and S6. And P2 is functional with respect to the partition S1, S2, S3, S4, S5, S6, S7, and S8. Now, I would say something strange here. Actually, it's very important. We didn't never say it explicitly in the paper, and it yielded all kind of issues and things by people who read the paper, misread the paper. So, What do you see? Like D1, you see S1, S2, S3, S4, S7, S8, S5, and S6. Now if you look at P1 and you forget about P2, what are the signals? 1, 2, 5, and 6. Right? So where does S3, S4, S7, S8 come into play? Well, think about what we say to be the behavior, the composite behavior of a system given two parts, right? We have to take the intersection, right? So what we have to do is that we have to insert all the signals in all the processes, because otherwise the intersection is not specified. Now, the interesting thing is that the set of behaviors of process P1 in this space will have S3, S4, S7, S8, so these four signals, that is all possible values. So it's not restrictive with respect to these four values, it's the entire set. Okay. Now, this is must be, because otherwise you don't know how to compose the system. So every subsystem has to be defined over the entire space of signals, even though they don't appear in its expression, because otherwise I can't do the algebra, right? So that's what I wanted to point out. It's very important, because otherwise nothing works in terms of the algebra that we presented. And same thing, P2, notice S3, S4, S7, S8, and there is no S1, S2, but yet we, S5, S6, but yet we put it explicitly over there. Okay, so suppose that P1 and P2 are functional this way. The key question that we would like to ask is that, is true that Q prime is functional with respect to S1 and S4 and S5, S6, S7, S8 as the output space? The answer, it depends. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. Right? So which means that if you take two processes that behave correctly, quote unquote, with respect to the notion of correctness to be functional, so to having one input equal to one output, if I compose these two processes, can I say the same? Can I claim that their composition gives me a system that has the same properties as two subsystems? And the answer is no. Why is that? Well, I mean, if you cascade them, then you can be sure that that is true. But if you connect them in a feedback loop, not necessarily, right? Because if you connect in a feedback loop, there is this input equal output kind of thing that takes place. So you mix the equations, right? And so you may end up having multiple solutions to the nonlinear equation. Right? So if you cascade them, there is no way. Why is not? Because you have this process P1. Process P2, and P1 feeds into P2, it's the output, the same. So in this composite process, the input is this guy and the outputs are this guy. Okay. Now, what we want to know is that given one value of this guy, I'm going to have one output value, right? Because that means to be functional, right? So let's follow the reasoning. So I have one value here. How many values I have there? One. But these guys are the input to this. And so you got a precise input. This precise input cannot correspond to one output. Right? So this and that the composition is functional. Right? Now what's not true, if I put P1 and P2 this way, that I don't know. This comes here and this comes there, right? So this one, I don't know, because I'm creating a feedback loop, and if I assume that these are the primary inputs and I siphon out the output here, right? I may have P1 and P2 that are perfectly fine, but when I'm connecting them this way, I may not get a single solution. And we'll see some special case. So for example, take finite state machine, and we'll see this, a mealy finite state machine, right? And you connect to another mealy finite state machine in feedback, right? In a composition state. Now, what is a mealy machine? It says that the output of a mealy machine can be, at the same time, no delay with respect to the input, right? Now, this input, I put it as an input of the other guy, right? So, I have this input, and all of a sudden, I have, at the same time, the input of this guy. The output of this guy becomes the input of this guy, right? And so, since there is no delay, mealy machine, I get another set of values that come in. Now, if these values are the same as this, fine. If they are not, I have an inconsistency, right? So I have no behavior, right? And so I don't get a mealy machine as a corresponding as this interconnection here. So the feedback connection is always the big problem. Okay. Now, partially order of tags and events. So partial order, it means that there exists a reflexive antisymmetric matrix transitive relation between tags. Okay. So the strict partial order is when the relation is strictly less, not less or equal, right? Now, the ordering of tags induces an ordering of events, because in fact we say that E1 is ordered with respect to E2 is the tag, T2 is in relation with the tag T1. So I can infer an order on the events if we have an order on the tag. So we can say that an event comes before another event if, for example, the time associated with event 1 is smaller than the time associated with event 2. So that's when we embed it in tags. So the order between events is induced by the order of the tags. And the order of the tags is what matters, because remember that the tags tell me about the causality and ordering of the events, right? Because that's why we introduce the tags. Right? Now, the time system are such that the set of tags is totally ordered. A metric time is where T is a metric space. So when we can define distance, a metric between the elements of the tag T. So that's what I told you when we were talking about the synchronous reactive language, in which I don't have metric time. And so I cannot say what is the measure of the time that has quote-unquote passed between two subsequent reactions. Okay? So in fact, we talk, when we look at all the possible inputs of all the possible systems and particular reactions, and then we see that there is another reaction corresponding to another change in a particular input, well, we cannot say what is the difference between these two times, right? Because there is no matrix. So that's purely logical. So for example, in a synchronous reactive model, I can have a reaction that happens now, and then in implementation, then I can have another reaction which is going to occur 1 year from now, and then lots of reactions immediately after. That's still synchronous reactive, but I cannot put things in a matrix space, because I don't have that notion. I just simply know that things occur in a particular way, but I have no way to say what that way is. Now, continuous time, how do we represent continuous time? So a continuous time system is a matrix time system where T is a continuum. So in other words, when the set of tags is a continuum, right? So, which is then corresponding to a to the real in number in a connected and what is a continuum? A continuum is also called a closed connected set. A close connected set means that any, if I take all the limits of sequences defined on the set, all the limit points belong to the set itself. Right, so that's closed. And connected, it means that there exists no two disjoint open set O1 and O2 such that the union of the two is the entire set. Which means that there are no holes, right, in the set. So continuous time has this notion, so there is no holes between, say, time t1 and time t2. There must be 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, 1.4. Okay, so they cannot have a hiatus between two elements of the set. So, and that corresponds indeed to our notion of time as being a continuous flow. Now, then, a discrete event system. So you are given a system Q and a tuple of signal S in Q that satisfy the system. Then we get a set of tags, and we call them timestamps. Why they are timestamps? Because it's discrete, right? And so it is ordered, okay, like continuous time and so on, but you have a definite distance, if you like, between the two, and so it's not connected. So the set of tags T of S is not a connected set. So a two-sided discrete event system Q is a time system where for each S in Q there exists an order preserving bijection for some subset of the integer 2TS. So which means that goes to minus infinity to plus infinity, right? So it's two-sided system. And so the intuition here is any pair of events in a signal have a finite number of intervening events. So that's the reason why it's discrete. So if you didn't have a discrete notion, then you could have infinite number of points between two times. Now, one-sided discrete event system, instead of the integers, you have a map between the set of tags and the naturals. The naturals are positive numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and so on. And so again, intuitively, every signal has a first event. So we start from somewhere. The two-sided signals is that we don't start from anywhere. So it's infinite both ways. The one-sided starts from zero and goes on. Now, what about synchrony? Well, now that we have a text, we can talk about synchrony with respect to a set of text. So two events are synchronous if they have the same text. Now, notice that I can define synchronicity even without time, because the only thing that I'm interested in is the value of the text. So, that, for example, if I have a set of text that is green, blue, and yellow, if two events have the tag blue, blue, they are synchronous. Right? So it's two events. But of course, for us, synchronous means the same time, right? But because the notion of synchronicity came from a time world way before the computers were defined. So everything is continuous, and synchronicity is indeed the same time. Then if two signals are said synchronous, if all events in one signal are synchronous with an event in the other signal and vice versa. So it means that whatever events we have here, we have a corresponding event in the other one. Okay. So we start to synchronous. A system is synchronous if every signal in the system is synchronous with every other signal in the system itself. And that's pretty good. Now, if we have this notion of reaction, and we have, for example, a signal that doesn't have a value for a particular tag, then how can we make it, how can we talk about synchronous reactive system? We have to introduce, according to this definition, we have to introduce the absence of a signal. So only then we can talk about synchronous reactive model. So we have to introduce this lack of signal, otherwise we won't satisfy the definition of synchronicity. So a discrete time system is a synchronous discrete system, and by this definition, for example, the synchronous data flow that we saw is not really synchronous. because the synchronous data flow is the only thing that we know is a partial order. So in fact, I like to call them static data flow, not synchronous data flow. But again, traditionally they have been called that way, so what can I do? So the synchronous languages, as we said, Argos, Lustre, SRL, and so on, are synchronous only if we introduce this lack of value in the set of values, right? Because there may be that in a reaction there is some input that doesn't participate to that reaction, and in order again to have this notion of synchronicity, we have to put no value. So I look at it and there is nothing there. But I look at it. So the point of synchronous reactive is that you are forced to look at all the inputs, right? You can't skip. And so in fact that's one of the interesting things when you implement synchronous reactive system, it can be wasteful because we have to look at inputs even they do nothing, right? And so that's wasteful. But it is then preventing all kind of weird behavior. So a causal process has a non-negative but possibly zero time delay from input to output, right? Which means that the outputs are really caused by the input. A strictly causal process has a positive time delay from input to output. So there is something that we can really measure between when I have an input and when the output comes out. A delta causal process is a time delay from input to output of at least delta. Now this will be extremely useful to guarantee the, for example, determinacy of feedback of things that are connected in feedback. So the fact that you have a delta causality is key. And that's obvious because you can see that if you have a particular behavior, if every output comes after delta time, at least delta time, from the input, then you prevent all kinds of weird behavior like we saw before when we said that two things were absolutely happening at the same time. Remember when we started the discussion of a text signal model, we had that situation with the input feeding two blocks, right? Now, in that case, all the ambiguity is gone. Because in this particular case, this block, which is in between, is if it is delta causal, then this guy is going to happen after this, and so the correct sequence is unique, right? So, which is this input, this guy computes, as a reaction comes out, then this guy comes in, and you compute again. In one-sided discrete event system, where without loss of generality, we say that T is the set of integers from 0 to infinity, we define a particular matrix, and this is kind of interesting. The Cantor matrix is very interesting and very useful. Now, the Cantor matrix is a generalization of the particular exponential matrix, so-called exponential matrix that is used in continuous systems. And the notion of this distance is when you pick up signals, you have, for example, a signal like this, and a signal like this. Now you notice that for some instant period of time, they are identical. And so all of a sudden they start diverging. So what this matrix says is that you pick up the first time, suppose this is discrete, right? So we are looking at times only here, here. So this is the first time in which these two signals diverge. Okay? So we say that the distance between these two signals is 1 over 2 to the power t. Right? So if this t is very large, then this number is very small, which means that the distance between these two guys is small. Which means that they are almost the same, right, for a certain number of times. Now, so suppose that this is a case when this does like this, or does like this. It doesn't matter. The distance is the same. So what we are concerned about is the first time when the two signals differ. Now, how many of you remember or have heard of the proof of existence and uniqueness of a solution of a differential equation? It's the Peano-Picard-Lindelof theorem. So everybody of this, so Lindelof is Swedish, Picard was a French, and Peano was an Italian. Right? So each one of them claimed that they were the first guy who invented it. So to cut the thing short, they said, okay, Peano, Picard, Lindelof. But they didn't do the work together. Okay. So, well, the proof of the existence and uniqueness of a solution goes like this. You have x dot equal to f of x. Then you actually write this as x equal to the integral of f of x plus x0, right? This is the initial value, and this is the integral between x0 and infinity, okay? Now then, how does the proof proceed, right? You have to assume that f is continuous, otherwise nothing works, but assume that actually piecewise continuous. But now, if you do this, then what you can interpret this to be is a fixed point, right? It's a function of fixed point. So with x is a waveform, right? Now, if x is a waveform, what you will see is that if you start the iteration with a particular value, you plug it here, you take the integrand, you see what this value is, you take this value, plug it in, you take this waveform, you plug it in, and you integrate again, and so on and so forth. Then what happened is, actually, sorry, this is from T0 doing things. Okay, now, what if you keep on doing this, what you get is a sequence of waveforms. This time, and this is the value x. So what you see is that the first iteration, you may get this. The second iteration, you may get this. The third iteration, you may get that. The fourth iteration, you get this. The fifth iteration, you get that, and so on. So what it means is that as you keep on iterating, the distance between the waveform at the input to the output decreases, right? And decreases by a finite amount, so that in the end, when you have an infinite number of iteration, you go down to zero. The distance is zero. So which means that the solution exists and is unique. So that is where this idea of the Cantor's matrix comes. It's by looking at this fixed-point solution, if you like, of a particular set of functional equations. So this one is telling you, in some sense, how fast you make a functional iteration to converge. Right? And so now you may see where this is interesting or is important. When we will look at the solution of this problem here, and so we will see when this thing is makes sense. So the causality definition then in the Cantor matrix space is when the distance between f of s and f of s prime is less than the distance between s and s prime. You see? So you have a process, you put the particular set of signal in, you compute f of s and f of s prime. If the distance of these two guys is less than the original distance, then you say that the system is causal. The strict causality, when the difference is strict, and the delta causality is when there exists a k less than 1, such that the distance between the two guys is less than k times the distance between s and s prime. Now you see that this is exactly what I was saying about the iteration that I was talking about, because what you can imagine is this is one value and this is the value at the next iteration, and if this property occurs, then you see that this is a sequence that cannot but go down to zero. And in fact, this is the definition of a contraction mapping, in the sense that we know that if you have a fixed point and f is a contraction mapping, then you have convergence. Now, notice that in the case of delta causality, then the value of k can be determined by 1 over 2 times delta, where delta is the constant in the causality measure. Okay. Now let's look at the various way of composing things. Actually, we'll see it on Thursday. No, Thursday. Tuesday. It is Thursday. We'll go on and complete this analysis of signal using the tag signal model. Okay.